Spirit Radio Podcasts.
On the line now for this week's Home and Lifestyle Tips, we have Therese Davy. Good morning to you, Therese. How was your weekend?
Wonderful. But at one stage, I had to drive from Limerick to Athlone, and it was I took the traditional road, not the motorway, and I certainly was praying on that road for a guiding light because the road was getting a bit bumpy and dangerous, and I was just smiling away listening to that song, and I said, yeah, I used that. I used the guiding light of faith last Saturday on the way in the dark.
I got you home safe and sound.
God, but I think I need to get the car checked. Yeah, the suspension may be a little bit dodgy.
Well, that sounds like a job of a week you have to do, but you have another job of the week for us, Therese.
It's getting colder, Wendy.
I know. I was feeling it. Trust me, I had the thermals on this weekend, the woolly socks.
Good. I hope they were matching. It is getting a little colder, so there's a couple of things we have to do. But first of all, the job of the week is an easy one. Go check your first aid kit and make sure everything is in date. This is the biannual check of the first aid kit. This is the winter check. And are you winter ready in the first aid kit? Have you got the packet of lockets, the basic cough bottle, and the squeezy honey, which, by the way, is cheaper than the jars? I often say check the per kilo price of things and you'll be surprised. So the squeezy honey is definitely cheaper than the jars of honey.
And the per kilo price, it's usually in the kind of small print when you look at the price labels in the supermarket, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, down in the bottom, per kilo price. And check it for things like ham or stuff you're buying regularly, meat. And you'd be very, very surprised, chicken fillets versus a chicken breast. You'd be very surprised at how sometimes some things are cheaper and you think they might be more expensive because the way they're presented or they're cut up or something. But just maybe to think about it and get your train yourself to look at the per kilo price. But back to the squeezy honey for the sore throats, just have a carton or a tube of it ready. And the website of the week is also tied into that, and I unashamedly mention it twice a year, undertheweather.ie, because there are great tips and straightforward professional advice from doctors and pharmacists on how to treat the regular illnesses, the coughs, the colds, the temperatures, the upset tummies, but always, always there is the provider that looking at a website does not replace a visit to a doctor, and you as a mum know that, Wendy. There is a time when you really need to go and you really need to know when to go, but certainly go to the websites first, and undertheweather.ie is a great and useful little one to know and have there on your speedy dial thing.
And you know, one of the really important things about that, especially at this time of year, Therese, is knowing the difference between a viral infection, which antibiotics will do nothing for, and you just need to build up your immune system, because I don't know what it is about the Irish psyche. It's only talking to a friend of mine who is a nurse at the weekend saying, when Irish people leave the doctor or the hospital or whatever and it's a viral infection, they can you not give me something? We're obsessed with taking an antibiotic when a lot of the time it won't do anything, and in fact obviously impacts our immune system.
Absolutely, and sometimes longer term for some people to recover and build up their immunity again, because they may have a poor diet or maybe in their system that they may be slower to recover. And you absolutely, Wendy, the difference between bacterial and viral infections, and the point is, an antibiotic does not cure a cold and does not cure a flu. And, you know, our doctors sometimes may be possibly to blame for that in a little, you know, trying to appease us and send us out with the cure. But surely the cure is knowing that you need to fight your own immunity. This is it. This is what you have. And it will go in 3 weeks. I think we're impatient too, Wendy. It takes 3 weeks for a cold to go away. And last year it was taking 4 weeks. It was a tough one. You know,
and it kind of lingers. So is it more like you were saying just with the honey, that it's more about kind of managing it and helping yourself feel as well as you can?
Treating the symptoms. You're not going to treat the cause, because the antibiotic won't treat the cause. You are treating symptoms. The soreness, the tiredness, the stuffed nose, you know, you're treating the symptoms, and that's what you need to have ready in the first aid kit. Those kind of things, the Vicks vapor rub, the honey for the sore throat, go out and buy the lemon and ease your symptoms as you wait through the 3 weeks. And that's it. Undertheweather.ie is that website, and a little bit of patience. The event of the week, LibraryIrelandWeek.ie. Do you like libraries?
Do you know what? There is a library quite close to where I live. It's recently enough built. It's in a place called Dunleary in South County Dublin, beautiful part of the country, and it's called the Lexicon Library. It's humongous. It's open on a Sunday, and went for a little pot around there yesterday. It was just fabulous. I think libraries are one of the most underused resources I've discovered again since having Matthew, because wanting to get him used to being in a library and reading, and also just from a financial perspective, I think people forget when you go with technology now, if there's a book that you're looking for online and you go online to your library, you can see if they have it, you can order it, you get a text when it arrives in, and you don't have to spend the cash on it.
And you can reserve it and read it and bring it back and someone else can enjoy it. It won't be sitting on your shelf. It's recycling and reuse in its own way, library books. And I use it for travel books when I'm going on holidays. Rather than have a collection of travel books on places you might never go back to, I go to the library, I order the book, I read it before I go, take my little notes and off I go. And they're amazing places, lectures, the various things that happen, the children's books and the online stuff. But there's not just library as in book libraries. There's also music libraries in Ireland. And so this is Library Ireland Week, and libraryirelandweek.ie is the website. There's something happening in your county. I can see the skills for job seekers in Wexford Library this Thursday. There's lectures going on. There's music. The Contemporary Music Library has a series of online articles all throughout next week. Skibbereen Library has a creative writing workshop on the 1st of December. So there's a taste of some of the things that's out there in this week, and it might bring you back to your library. And I remember every Saturday we went with our parents to the library to get our books changed. It was part of our life. It was part of our lifestyle. And we got our three books and we saved money and we got out and we just enjoyed libraries. I think they're great. I think it's wonderful, Terry, you're bringing Matthew to the library.
And I do. I think it's really great for kids to just have that experience. And libraries now are really making an effort to do. Like, that's another thing I would say to parents, and not just parents, by the way, is go online and see. And I'm sure that website has links to it. The events that take place in your library. For me, obviously, mm-hmm. I'm aware of, you know, story time and music and stuff for kids. But there's all sorts of language groups. But it's just brilliant. It's a resource really should tap into, especially when it's a nice warm place to be indoors during this time of the year. As you said, it's getting colder.
It is getting colder. And on the subject of books, they're always a great gift. And please support our advertisers on Spirit Radio. But if you know someone who got the papers this weekend, Dubray Books have a voucher offer in their little magazine. €3 off if you spend 30, 5 and 10 if you spend 50 and 100 euro respectively. So if you know someone who has that little, if you intend getting books, it could be used for a little, save a few pounds for yourself as well. But keeping your house warm is what I want to talk about. Just quickly go through a couple of points, because I started on about the draft excluders last
I know
weekend.
And I went and I got the draft strips through the front door and they were too thick anyway. I didn't get the right ones, even though it said it's all windows and doors on it. But anyway, I'll have to go back to the drawing board on that one.
Yeah, that's why I said measured it, because there are varied thickness, you're right, but they are worth it. Use your curtains. Keep them open during the day, let the sunlight in, that's free heat. And when it gets dark, you shut them. They're another layer of insulation and they keep heat in the rooms. But keep them open during the day, don't leave the curtains closed and let the light and heat in. Here was an interesting one, I'd never heard of this before. The timers for the central heating. If you lower the temperature and put it on 30 minutes earlier in the morning, it's more efficient. Because the boiler heats up at a constant speed. So people make the mistake of putting on the heat high when they come in to heat a room. But put it on a little lower for a little longer. It's better value and it works better. Never thought of it before, never heard of it before. Moving your sofa. People have put their sofa in front of the radiator and it's absorbing heat that could be warming the room. You need to take things away from the radiator to let the hot air circulate freely. And that includes taking the clothes off them. Put them on the clothes horse, maybe close enough to them or near them or close to them at night when you're switching it off. But you need to let the air from the radiator circulate freely. It makes sense when you think about it, doesn't it?
I know, and I suppose the tricky thing is when you just have a room that's too small that you've nowhere else to put the couch or the bed or whatever other than in front of the radiator.
Yeah, and maybe anyone who's building, they might think about that, putting one of those tall radiators up along a wall that might be needed or used. The insulation, we talk about it once a year, and there's grants out there, but the 25% of the heat is through the roof, and as I keep saying, the cheapest way to get the return in insulation is doubling the insulation in the attic. Wrap up warm, and that's not you, Wendy, although you were doing it this weekend. The water tank, it'll keep the water warmer for longer, it makes sense, and there's grants for that as well. Turn down the dial. that might be counterintuitive, but if you turn down, the World Health Organization say a minimum temperature of 21 degrees in the living room, but the Public Health Society in England say 18 degrees.
Okay.
But if you turn it down, you could cut your heating bill by 10%. So 18, 19 degrees, and do what we said earlier, putting it on a bit earlier. Block out the drafts, we talked about that, but you can make, and here's another job of the week maybe, all those extra socks and odd socks and tights you don't have, make a sausage dog. Make a draft,
so
exclude yourself.
You stuff an old pair of tights with the odd socks that you're going to throw out, is that it?
Absolutely, and all the pop socks that don't match, don't dump them, make them into something, or get the children to make them into something, and get your boiler, the usual story, get your boiler serviced regularly. It works, it makes it more efficient, and maybe you might need to replace it. You just might need to. So there's a couple of tips in keeping the house warm.
We're going to be all toasty with thanks to you, Trace. As always, great home and lifestyle tips, and we'll talk to you the same time next week.
Stay warm. Bye-bye.
Annual Irish Catholic Doctors Learning Network conference taking place on Saturday the 8th of December. Very interesting title for the conference, Ethics and Professionalism Informed by Faith. And I suppose for a lot of us where our faith is an important part of our lives, maybe it's just something that kind of intuitively happens, or maybe something really to bring back into focus is, well, how does faith help me to carry out my work, whatever I do, or just my daily life in a more ethical way, in a more professional way? So it'll be very interesting to hear what our next guest has to say about his own experience of this and indeed some of the topics that are going to be discussed at the conference. On the line I have Dr. Niall Breslin, who's a consultant gastroenterologist and hepatologist at Talla Hospital. Niall, good morning to you.
Good morning, Wendy, and thank you so much for having me on your show this morning to discuss our fourth annual conference of the Irish Catholic Doctors Learning Network. As you say, it's entitled Ethics and Professionalism Informed by Faith, and it's taking place on Saturday, 8th of December at the Amos Retreat Centre in Swords, County Dublin. We're kicking off around 8.30 with registration and finishing at 5 p.m. and the meeting attracts 6 CME points. I'd stress that it should be of interest really to all Catholic healthcare professionals. Lunch will be served and we'll be having registration at the venue, but ideally we'd like people to register on our website beforehand to allow planning for catering. And I'll just give the website if that's okay, Wendy. It's ICDLN, that's Irish Catholic Doctors Learning Network, icdln.ie, and it's in the Spirit Radio events guide as well.
Great stuff. Well, just in terms of the topic then, Niall, and just kind of bringing it back to that of just ethics, professionalism and our faith kind of being a part of that. Talk to me just a little bit about your own experience. Is it something that obviously the conference is going to focus on it, but do you think we focus on it enough, and how does it impact you just in your work every day?
I think, as you suggest, it's something that does impact on our daily practice, but that we're probably not altogether aware of it. It comes, I suppose, to some extent naturally, and ethical and moral values have sort of underpinned our practice from I guess the time of Hippocrates, but it's certainly been brought into focus in a more real way with I suppose the repeal of the Eighth Amendment and the possibilities of doctors who have conscientious objection being forced to make arrangements for transfer of care of patients requesting an abortion, but thereby making us sort of complicit in that act. So I think, yes, it's there in the background. I have to say, from my recollection of college, there was very little ethics taught. I would hope that is changing over time, but probably not given enough attention.
In terms of just the topic you touched on there, which obviously for, I imagine, many of the medical professionals attending the conference are thinking of attending, the new reality now that there will be abortion in GP practices, some maternity hospitals, how will you be focusing on this topic of just how medics should be, you know, handling, but also the ethics of conscientious objection?
So I think it's a really good point. And, you know, we know from the, you know, the GPs will sort of bear the brunt of this service. I think probably about 90%, it's projected, of these abortions will take place in general practice. We know from the Irish College of General Practitioners that from their 3,500 members that only 32% are prepared to carry out abortions. 68% will not provide for a variety of reasons. And 25% specifically state, you know, conscientious objection has been a reason not to. And similar sort of figures from the National Association of General Practitioners. So I think that through through the conference, we're hoping to touch on these issues. It's not going to be all about conscientious objection. I would sort of point out it's more in terms of general ethics as well. But we have John Bruton coming to talk to us on maintaining medical ethics in a changing environment. John, as you know, and is known to all your listeners, has been former Taoiseach, has been a very potent advocate for doctors and healthcare personnel who have conscientious objections to abortion. So he should be fantastic. Bishop John Keenan is coming over from Scotland. He's the Bishop of Paisley. He has a long history of lecturing and philosophy at Scottish College in Glasgow. He's a former chaplain to the Scottish Medical Association. He's going to talk on the impact of philosophy and ethics on clinical practice today, I suppose, how we got here, and I suppose the historical influence of philosophy and ethics and the current influence. We also have Ciarán Craven, who's a barrister and medical doctor with, you know, special interest in, I suppose, in medical legal issues, who's going to talk on the potential impact of the abortion bill on medical practice in Ireland. And I think, I suppose, our concerns really are not only, you know, abortion, unfortunately, is here in the format proposed, the other concerns beyond conscientious objection are really, what about end-of-life issues, euthanasia, assisted suicide? So I think this old bill has, you know, has certainly shook us up in regard to that. Barbara Golden is a former member of the Irish Medical Council, where she served for 5 years. She's a consultant anaesthetist in Dublin, has an MBA in health management. So she's going to give us her own, I suppose, unique insights into the benefits and pitfalls of conscientious objection, either downsides to conscientious objection, as well as, you know, benefits from an ethical perspective in healthcare. And then, just to sort of, I suppose, change the flavour a little bit of the meeting, Aisling Bastable is a GP who is going to speak on the delivery of medical care to women living in disadvantaged circumstances. Aisling worked for about 8 years in a primary care practice in Dorchester, Massachusetts, Boston, which is quite an underprivileged area. And she continues to spend a month with Spirazi, which is the Centre for Care of Survivors of Torture, where she sees patients from various countries who are victims of torture. So I think she's going to give us a really, really unique insight into that area that most of us will never really encounter and hope never to encounter.
So there's a really interesting mix of speakers there, Niall. And it's interesting to hear you say there wasn't that much discussion on ethics when you kind of remember back to your college days. Do you think it's something that medical professionals, doctors, nurses can talk about openly, the kind of ethics that inform their daily life?
I think to a certain extent, but I think that, you know, that obviously, you know, abortion, end-of-life issues, euthanasia are very polarised subjects, particularly maybe abortion in our country at the moment. And I think it is difficult to sort of have those discussions that touch on those areas without sort of, running the risk of disagreement. So I think it's to find a forum where we can agree on what we agree on. And obviously those of us who hold, the life of the unborn dear, would wish to be also able to have a conscientious objection to abortion.
And finally, now, I'll just ask you, what do you hope people will get from the conference that attend on the 8th of December?
I think a fuller understanding of the whole area of conscience, conscientious objection, and how it interacts with ethics. I think the idea that conscientious objection mightn't always be good is important to acknowledge and recognise. And ultimately, I suppose, for people to continue to advocate as vigorously as possible for that change in the proposed law and in how the Medical Council believes that doctors with conscientious objection should behave on this matter, because really it seems very obviously a basic human right. So I think if we get a groundswell of opinion and let people know. I mean, 25% of doctors, GPs, objecting, you know, or having a conscientious objection is a pretty, you know, substantial number. Not a majority, but certainly worthy of listening to.
Niall, thanks so much for joining us on the programme this morning. That's Dr. Niall Breslin there. Just to give you the details of that conference that Niall was talking about, you can get all the details at icdln.ie. There was a recent article in the Daily Mail last week which was looking at one particular school in the UK where it had 17 children undergoing a process to change their gender. So children who said they identified as a different gender to their biological gender. And a concerned teacher says that vulnerable pupils are being tricked into believing they are the wrong sex. On the line to tell us a little bit more about this story, it's actually not an isolated incident. There's been similar spikes in other schools in the UK. We have Stephanie Davis-Arai, who's the director of Transgender Trend. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit more about this school then that was reported on last week.
Yes, it's a school in Brighton, which is sort of near the area that I live. And I know that Brighton is very progressive, as they say, in terms of trans rights. And in Brighton, there is an organisation called the All Sorts Youth Project, who have written a transgender inclusion schools toolkit, which has gone into all secondary schools across Brighton and some primary schools. And some schools have very enthusiastically taken this up and sort of changed their policies based on the guidance issued by All Sorts. And the guidance is very, well, in my view, very extreme. It takes away any single sex spaces, so sex-based protections for girls and all sex-based privacy for both sexes, so toilets and changing rooms, etc.
So from what age would they be kind of advocating that then?
Well, they All Sorts run a group, a trans and gender variant group for 5 to 11-year-olds. So they are promoting this, for the youngest ages. And this school's guidance is used in some primary schools as well.
In this story, what was interesting and I suppose probably worrying for some parents, Stephanie, is that the teacher who was talking about her experience, she said that a lot of the young people who were having, trying to basically change their gender were autistic, and she believed they were being tricked into believing they were the wrong sex and that they were suffering from gender dysphoria, and that perhaps that they were using trying to change their sex as a way with coping with other underlying issues.
It's a really concerning issue. 35% of the children who are referred to the Tavistock Clinic in London are on the autism spectrum. We know that there is this link, and that autistic children and ASD children are particularly vulnerable to this idea that they are the opposite sex if they have atypical interests for their own sex. You know, if they're gender non-conforming or if they defy gender stereotypes. And this is not being investigated as I think it should be. But there's also the fact that quite vulnerable children, those who don't adhere to sex stereotypes, are particularly vulnerable to this idea that means you might be the opposite sex. Those who are bullied, who are isolated, we're seeing children who have suffered previous trauma, even previous sexual abuse. And the problem is that everywhere they turn, whether it's their schools or whether it's the NSPCC and Childline or whether it's therapists and counsellors, are all affirming. You know, if a girl says, I identify as a boy, then she is affirmed as a boy, because there is it's been put out that any other response is akin to conversion therapy. But of course, you have to explore underlying issues that may have led to a child's gender dysphoria. And I think it's become a very political issue. We're saying, well, a child is transgender as an explanation for a child who identifies as the opposite sex. But historically, there are lots of reasons behind that, which we know, which are recognised. And those issues need exploring first. A child, and particularly a vulnerable teenager, needs help to explore the underlying issues. No form of conversion therapy. It's just making sure that the child is not going into something that will lead to irreversible and lifetime medication because of a misunderstanding about why they feel the way they do.
And is there any effort? I mean, I'm just thinking of my own experience, Stephanie. When I was younger, when I was in school, I suffered with an eating disorder for many years. And the underlying issue with that was confidence, lots of things. But obviously part of it is that you dislike the body that you see in front of you. And you know, it takes, and any woman who's had that experience will know that you, thank God, if you get the right help, it's really helping you to learn to accept your body as it is. And I can't help but think that there could, when I was going through that, because I disliked my body so much, if an option was to say, actually, you know what, I'd rather be a boy and dress like a boy, it would have actually been another outlet for me to have, I suppose, hidden my body. And that's just an example I'm thinking of, that could be an underlying reason for some girls who say they're boys. But
there are a lot of adult women who would relate to what you're saying, that adolescence it's difficult for all kids. But I think it's particularly difficult for girls when girls start developing sexually and getting curves, and they're no longer that sort of have the freedom of that sort of androgyny they have as children, and they suddenly become objects for men to leer at or shout at or even try and touch, and they, you know, their bodies almost become public property, or they feel too fat, they feel that their bodies betray them at puberty. I think that it's not surprising that it's over 70% of children referred and teenagers referred to the Tavistock Clinic are girls, because it seems to me that gender dysphoria and this sort of new way of understanding your body hatred and body disassociation, that you actually should be a boy, it has met a kind of market in waiting of adolescent girls. And if you look at the diagnostic criteria for gender dysphoria, you want to be treated as a member of the opposite sex. You feel that you have the thoughts and feelings of the opposite sex. I think a lot of girls at adolescence would say that. Yes, I'm just as, you know, I'm a human being like boys are. I'm not a sex object. You know, I'm a person. I want to be treated as boys are treated. I want to be treated with more respect and not as just a sex object. So I think that there's a very fine line between the diagnosis of gender dysphoria and the diagnosis of being a teenage girl.
Do you think, just when you talk about, you know, the toolkits that schools are given, and it just seems to be this issue, the most kind of popular one to be talking about at the moment, to be, you know, kind of tagging yourself onto, and look, when it comes to growing up, there's so many different issues that young people face, and I guess it's about learning to respect everyone. But when you see spikes like in the school in Brighton, I can't help but think of this kind of copycatting going on. So is there any explanation for the fact that, well, there's so many in one area? I mean, if it was something that you said, okay, it occurs in X percentage of people in the population, I would say it's very, very low overall, then how can it be explained, a large group in one school?
I think the transgender lobbying groups deny that there is any social contagion involved with this. But I think if you look at the situation in Brighton, and Brighton, Sussex and Kent, which are the ones that use the All Sorts toolkit, have, I think, twice as many referrals to the Tavistock Clinic as Greater London, and it's an area of half the population. I think it's so clear that if you're a teenager, you're a confused teenager, maybe an unhappy and isolated teenager, and all the adults in your life, trusted adults, your parents perhaps, your teachers, the therapists, online advice is all, as well as Tumblr and all the trans forums online which teenagers are looking at, but everybody is reinforcing the same idea, yes, you're really a boy, or yes, you're really a girl, and the other. I think, you know, that can't help but be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Where can children go, where can teenagers go to get any other understanding of why they feel the way they do? Because it's being painted as transphobic if you even say, well, you could be feeling like that because, you know, or just talking to a child about well, you know, what does feeling like a boy mean? What does being a boy allow you to do that being a girl doesn't allow you to do? And actually explore the issues with a teenager. Nobody's doing it. No adults are doing
that.
And
is that one of the
problems? Or very few. It's very difficult to find a therapist who will actually work with a child and look at psychological issues. Because therapists are afraid of being accused of conversion therapy if they do so.
It's one thing for a therapist to be afraid, but it's a wholly, entirely different matter, Stephanie, for parents to be worried to talk to their own children. We're talking about children who are ages where they can't decide their own bedtime, but we're saying, yes, you can decide your own gender. I know that in the UK, that's some. I was reading something about a family in, it wasn't in Brighton, I don't think, but a 15-year-old girl was taken into care after her parents wanted to question her desire to,
yes,
be a boy. I mean, that has serious implications from a parenting perspective.
And there's that threat there, and you know, from all the transgender lobby organisations, including All Sorts, that social services may need to be informed if the parent. The parent is seen as a bigot and an unsupportive parent unless they immediately affirm their child and basically encourage them towards a path of medical transition, because that is the pathway for children. There isn't another pathway. There isn't a psychological or therapeutic pathway. There is only the medical pathway. So if you're a parent and you're desperately worried, I mean, I of course, I'm contacted by a lot of parents who are absolutely devastated. And, you know, this is sort of breaking families apart. It is a huge issue that they are... Families desperately trying to, allow their children to express themselves, but trying to prevent them from going, you know, girls going on to testosterone, which has irreversible effects on their bodies. I think the biggest thing, so there's that threat in the background of social services being called, but I think the biggest threat and the cruelest threat to parents is this idea that is being promoted continually, that if you don't allow your child to medically transition, that they will commit suicide, or there's an increased chance that they will commit suicide. And what parent can risk that?
And with the evidence says the opposite, doesn't it, in terms of children who do transition, that actually their instances of self-harm and suicide are much higher after
they
transition.
Well, you see, if you look at the self-harm stats, is that because they are trans, or is that because they have underlying mental health issues that have not been dealt with and will not be dealt with as long as we're affirming a child as trans? They're not getting the help for underlying mental health issues. So you can't, you know, you just can't say that these children have a higher suicidal ideation because they are trans, if you're not exploring the underlying mental health issues first. But also the suicide ideation stats, yeah, we recognise that there is a high suicidal ideation. It doesn't change in adults. It doesn't change. You know, medical transition doesn't work to alleviate that. But also the stats put out by groups like Stonewall saying 48%. Well, at the Tavistock they say 1%. And actually the sort of self-harm and suicidal ideation level is the same as the level at CAMHS, the mental health service. So children that go to CAMHS with mental health issues have a elevated rate compared to other children. And the children referred to the Tavistock Clinic have the same rate. So I think it's a real, really cruel emotional manipulation to tell parents continually that their child is at risk of suicide if they don't allow them to transition. And the other thing is that children themselves, teenagers themselves, are encouraged to believe that and encouraged online to threaten their parents with the same thing. If you don't allow me, I will commit suicide.
Finally, just to ask you then, Stephanie, when I think of especially younger children and teenagers, where they are allowed to make life-changing alterations to their bodies, whether it's girls cutting off their breasts or taking hormones like testosterone that could affect their fertility in the future, is it going to take a critical mass of parents or brave politicians who'll put their head above the parapet to say, hang on, in no other area do we kind of railroad ahead with life-altering treatment ahead of the kind of evidence that this is actually a positive thing?
It's going to take a lot more people having more courage to stand up and speak. And we've heard that politicians themselves dare not speak in this area. David Davis MP has done. He sort of stands out as the one politician who is talking about this in the UK Parliament. But yes, politicians are afraid to speak about it because of the accusation of transphobia, and I think there are LGBT groups and in societies within every political party who are dictating the policies and the line on this, and nobody dares go against them because we know what happens to people who, I mean, I get a constant targeted harassment and attempts to shut my voice down and silence me, and it's horrible. And if you're a politician, at the moment it's sort of political suicide to speak out on this, and actually particularly if you're a woman. But people, I think we are actually seeing a bit of a shift. We've had much more media coverage, and teachers and professionals speaking out to the media, even anonymously, is helping, because everybody who speaks out gives permission for other people to speak out. And I think we are seeing a bit of a shift in how much people are, you know, willing to say publicly. And I'm hoping that we've reached a point where it will now start, you know, it will start snowballing, that more people will speak out.
And it takes courage, but it is so, so important, especially when it impacts the well-being of our children. Stephanie Davis, yes. Sorry, thanks so much for joining us
Thank
on
Spirit you.
Radio this morning. And Stephanie is involved with Transgender Trend, if you want to look up their website for information, support, and indeed a huge amount of, you can get access to huge amounts of research on this particular issue. I know that many of our listeners over the years that I have been working on Spirit Radio have gotten in touch with us when we cover issues in a different way, and they say, look, thank you for covering that topic in a particular way. Thank you for hearing both sides of the story, or thank you for seeking out the truth. That's something that we've been able to do here at Spirit Radio because we're independent. You know, we're not owned by a big media conglomerate who, unfortunately, media has changed so much. You know, it used to be a case of a journalist, for example, was sent out to follow a story, to cover a story, and to investigate. Now, oftentimes what you have is newspapers and television stations saying this is the editorial line that we are taking on something, and that is not a good direction that media is going in. And I know that many of our listeners get frustrated at feeling that there is just kind of one-sided reporting on lots of different issues. But where has this come from? It's nuanced, of course. There's so many different root causes to it. Well, there's an event upcoming that might really interest you in getting your juices flowing, talking about this, debating about this, and hearing what others have to say on this matter. And it's all about that. It's looking at the freedom of the press, making sure that all voices are heard and all that sort of stuff. But I will get it explained much better by my next guest in studio, who's involved with an organisation called Moot. And Carl Hutchinson joins me in studio. Good morning to you, Carl.
Good morning, Wendy.
Moot. What's it all about?
Moot. Well, interestingly enough, the word moot derives from the Anglo-Saxon word, which means assembly to debate. So we became concerned, by concerned I mean myself and my colleagues within Moot, became concerned about the balance in discussion and debate that appeared to be developing within Irish society. There's a lot of topics out there and a lot of issues out there that we felt weren't being discussed in a balanced way. And we feel that the media have a big part to play in this. We feel that there's an ideological unity now within the media. And personally, I feel in talking to journalists, I feel that there is a concern within the journal community as well, that they feel they're always walking on eggshells, that they can't publish or talk about a lot of things that they would like to talk about. So we've brought together this programme on Saturday, which will be in the Radisson Blue Hotel in Golden Lane, entitled Freedom of the Press and Media. And the purpose behind it is basically to try and raise some of these questions, to challenge the issues behind it, to try and get an understanding as to what exactly is happening within the press and the media that's providing this sort of ideological
driving force, really.
But correct.
Do you think it's something, Carl, that in your lifetime as a media consumer, so your adult life, has it something that's changed quite rapidly, or has it been kind of slow drip effect, where all of a sudden you're kind of reading what's tagged as news, but it's editorial, it's opinion that you're reading, it's not the news being reported?
Yeah, I think actually, personally, I feel it's been a fairly quick change. I think it's probably started to happen in the last 5 to 6 years. You know, I'm a fairly level-headed individual. I believe I'm, I follow common sense and I believe in common sense, but I feel in a lot of ways things that are being reported now have no common sense element to them. So I'm all for bringing back common sense and discussion and debate on whatever topic it might be, because I think, you know, opinions matter. Everybody has a voice, and I feel everybody deserves to have their voice heard. And that's really what Moot is about. Moot is about providing people with the opportunity to voice their concerns, to voice their opinions in a way where they won't be ridiculed. That's very important, because I feel a lot of people are fearful about talking out these days. So Moot has been established just to provide that platform, and it's a forum for exactly that, for free speech, really.
I know one of the speakers, and you might tell us a little bit about the topic he's going to be talking about, that's going to be speaking about the event this weekend, is John Waters, journalist. And it made me, when I saw his name, it made me think about something that I think is really troubling, is that the very few voices that would be deemed as dissenters, but shouldn't really be, because they just try to espouse different viewpoints on lots of different topics. The few that we have had have slowly been sidelined, and their voices have been silenced. John is one, and he talks about that, his experience in the Irish Times. You had Kevin Myers, George Hook, the list kind of goes on. Anybody who kind of steps outside this tyranny of political correctness, of kind of the stated line on any particular issue, but politically hot ones or politically popular social issues, they're silenced very, very quickly. And that's kind of a worrying trend when it comes to just freedom of expression, when journalists themselves can't actually just do that, you know, let alone the wider society.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. And I mean, the default position now in relation to people who speak out on issues is, you know, you're scaremongering. You know, it's not something that really we want to discuss. Interestingly, I was listening to a debate the other day between Ivana Bacek and John Leahy, who the leader of Renew. It was an interesting debate on this issue over whether or not children who are children of non-nationals have the entitlement to citizenship. And Ivana brought this bill before the Senate, as we know. John Leahy was on talking about it with Ivana, and of course he made some very, I believe, some very astute points in relation to it. He argued them well, but the default position by Ivana, of course, was that, look, you know, you're scaremongering, you know, these issues aren't important. That is not the reality of the position. The position is that there are plenty of issues out there that are of importance to a lot of people. I don't think that we're getting the truth in relation to a lot of these matters. I think truth is of the essence of it. And really, I think in all debate and all discussion, truth should be at the heart of it. And that's really what Moot is trying to encourage. And so, you know,
and debate and discussion is one of the key things that I know you're hoping to have at the event this weekend. I mean, a topic we just covered there, we were talking about the transgender issue, especially how it impacts young people. One of the hashtags on Twitter that those who are really pushing that ideology is hashtag no debate. In other words, there's certain issues in our society where we should be discussing and debating them, and they're important. And it's just kind of shut down. It's seen as, no, you can't even debate it. So I think people feel themselves fear around, not saying I have an opinion either way on an issue sometimes, but just asking questions. So
correct.
Is that what you hope people will kind of get out of the event this weekend? A kind of a space to say, look, we need to be able to talk, to discuss, to debate. And it isn't about you having your opinion kind of bandied about. It's about both sides being heard.
Yes, that's exactly what it's about, Wendy. Because, I mean, there are issues there. There are difficult issues that have to be discussed and talked about in our society today. That's the reality of it. And we can't just deny that those, you know, discussions should never take place, or that changes within society are not taking place. Those changes, some of them are for the betterment of society, some I believe are not for the betterment of society. But that doesn't negate the fact that we have an entitlement to talk about them. As citizens of Ireland, we have that entitlement, and therefore we're welcoming of any and all views. But we want a balanced debate, and we want people who feel that their voices aren't being heard to feel comfortable and confident that they have a platform by which they could express those views.
So the event, which is taking place this Saturday, I'm going to be speaking at it from the perspective of a journalist, how I thought journalism was going to be when I studied it, you know, the core principles, all that sort of stuff, what the reality is. I see my experience as being, you know, I wouldn't call myself a dissenter, but for having a slightly different opinion on lots of different things, I'm called that. So I'll be talking about that and just my own experience as a young journalist in Ireland. Who else is going to be speaking at the conference, Carl?
Well, we've got David, Dr. David Thunder from the University of Navarra in Pamplona. He's written some very interesting articles in the Irish Times and in other publications. The Lazy Echo Chamber probably is the one that struck my attention, which he wrote a couple of months ago in the Irish Times, which he was talking about basically where the press, his view is the press and the media within Ireland basically are, you know, walking in ideological footstep, and there's no kind of differentiation between the media in Ireland now. So David will be over, he'll be talking specifically on that particular topic. We have Breda O'Brien, who is a journalist with the Irish Independent, and she'll be talking on a very interesting topic as well. She'll be talking on sins of omission, what the media rarely cover. So I'm looking forward to that. I can't give detail in relation to the specifics of it, but I certainly like the topic title, and I think it'll be, you know, well worth hearing. And then we have John Waters, who's talking about When We Were Free. And again, John, in his own inimitable way, obviously will cover a lot of issues in relation to the media and the press. I mean, he's a long knowledge, a long learning in relation to journalism, writing, social events, etc. So I think he'll certainly have some wonderful insights, as will you, Wendy, undoubtedly, in relation to your topic. So look, you know, I think it's going to be a great event. I'm hoping people will come along, that it'll be well received. It's the first event Moot has held. There will be other. We're running a Freedom Of series of talks, of which this will be the first. But there's plenty of other topics out there that need to be discussed. I think like freedom of conscience, for example, would be one I'd have in my mind now, perhaps for the next event, probably in the...
This will be the starting point. And I know already that lots of people have registered. There's kind of a limited capacity in the room that you have on the day. So basically for people who want to register, what's the best way for them to do that then, Carl?
Best way to register is go onto our website, moot.ie. Go into the events section of it and then just register there. It's very, very simple. So I'd call on you all, please, to get out there and register for this event. We need your support. We think it's worthy of support, and I think you'll enjoy the morning.
And it's a free event as well.
It's a free event. Teas and coffees will be served. 9:15 registration. Teas and coffees, nothing better. And then 11 o'clock, then there'll be a networking and break, and then the event itself then will probably finish for about 1:30, 1:45. We'll be allowing plenty of time for people on the floor and the attendees to have a say and to talk openly on the topic. So we're hoping for a robust but, balanced debate.
It sounds like it's going to be an interesting day. I, for one, am looking forward to it, and hopefully I will see some of you there. As Carl mentioned there, you can get all the details and register for your attendance at moot.ie. There is a limited capacity in the venue, which is the Radisson Blue Hotel in Golden Lane. I know it's very Irish of us to just turn up, but I would urge you just to register just so the organisers are able to make sure that they can accommodate for those who want to go to this event. Carl Hutchins, thanks for joining us on Spirit Radio.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.